Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. This episode of the Psychology Podcast is brought to you by Bombas. We're going to hear a little bit about them and their philanthropic mission later, but right now I'm really excited to be speaking with today's guest, Frederica Fabricius. Frederica is co-author with Hans Hagemann on the new book, The Leading Brain, Powerful Science-Based Strategies for Achieving Peak Performance. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Really enjoyed reading your book, The Leading Brain. It's a really fascinating for me to see how you apply the latest insights in neuroscience and neurochemistry to the business and leadership world. How often do you see kind of a marriage of those things?
Not very often, because, you know, I used to work in management consulting before and nobody there wanted to hear about neuroscience at all. I think they're now catching up, but when I worked there and I said something from my perspective as a neuropsychologist, they were just rolling their eyes. They were like, "We don't care, you know, get back to work." And then when I was at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research, where I started out, I always looked for applications, and people were not so very much interested in applications either, I found. So, you know, it was a real, I don't know how to call this, but for me, it was an epiphany when I was finally able to combine those two. It was a dream come true. Because when I wanted to work with leaders, but I realized that lots of the insights that people are giving to leaders, so lots of the advice that is given, is not science-based. And I think there's a lack. You cannot just go out and tell people to do things differently if you don't have any evidence that supports your advice.
Oh, I completely agree. And anyway, you're doing a great job with it. And I wanted to discuss some of these ideas from your book, starting with the you that motivates us. What is this you, this mysterious you that you talk about?
Yeah, well, it's the inverse U curve of peak performance. I also call this concept, or I like to call this concept, DNA of peak performance. It's about three substances that you need together in order to perform really well. And those three substances are dopamine, noradrenaline, and acetylcholine. And you need all three of them in order to perform at your best. And the key thing is, I also like to call this, maybe it's easier for our listeners to understand, fun, fear, and focus. So you need the fun when you're working, and then dopamine is released. And I'm not talking about after work fun, having coffee with your colleagues, or, you know, celebrating somebody's birthday at the office. I'm more about, you know, you should enjoy what you're doing in order to be high performing. And then you have the fear part. You know, imagine you were to interview the same person every single time you do your podcast. Would be probably very, maybe a little bit boring, you know. I don't want, unless it's a very, very interesting person, but you don't want to get too bored or too routined in a task. You always need a challenge. So this is about the fact that in order to get the noradrenaline flowing in your brain, you always need a challenge. You need to be slightly over-challenged. And then you have the focus. In order to get into flow, you need the focus. You really need to not multitask. You know, you shouldn't be checking your text messages while we are talking. I should, you know, we should be able to fully focus. And that's when acetylcholine is released. And acetylcholine is a substance that helps us to learn better. It helps us to concentrate in the here and now. Babies have it. You know, they are always in the presence. They don't think about tomorrow. They don't think about yesterday. They're always fully experiencing. So you need the fun, you need the fear, and you need the focus in order to perform well, in order to get into flow.
Fun, fear, and focus. How does this relate to the four Fs of stress?
I'm not familiar with the four Fs of stress, okay. But I think if I can tell you how it relates to stress, what Good. You need to
That'd
know
be great.
Is that, yeah, sometimes, you know, people, let's say you're having, I know you're doing a lot of talks and keynote speeches. Let's say you're invited to do a keynote speech and you're you know, a little bit nervous, and it's a very exciting big audience, and then you know very important people are watching and you're really a little bit nervous, that's good for your performance. But then let's say a minute before you're on stage, you realize that your data that you were going to present from your research is totally wrong. Somebody from your lab calls you and said, oh, Scott, we noticed all of the data is wrong. So, you know, you're just about to go on stage. That would probably push you over the edge. It would make you nervous to a degree where you can't really perform well anymore. And that's what you can call, you know, this state is called over-arousal. There's a correlation between the degree of nervousness you should be having and your performance. And maybe what puts you over, I don't know you so well, but maybe for you, it happens when all of your data is wrong. And I'm not saying this will ever happen to you. I'm just saying, you know, imagine for you, it would be happening then. For somebody else, it could be already that they wanted to have a coffee before and then there was no coffee and they're already totally nervous. So it depends a lot what makes people nervous. But everybody doesn't perform well anymore when they're overly stressed. So you need to understand where your personal comfort zone is, and you need to always be slightly above that in order to perform well.
Yeah, I actually was going to say that I reach that when I have too much coffee, not when I can't find my coffee. It's probably good that I can't find my coffee sometimes.
Yeah, and then, you know, it's also happening to many people that they have very boring jobs, or they've been in the same job for a very long time. And then what happens then is that you go through the motions, you do your job, but you're a little bit bored. People might think you perform well, but in reality, you're underperforming. And that, from a, you know, a psychology term, would be called under arousal. So in order to get into peak performance, you need to be not underperforming, you know, not bored out and not overly stressed. And the art is to get that right and to stimulate yourself at your work so that you can get into the zone.
Yeah, it's not easy, is it?
No. And, you know, research has shown that people are 5 times more productive when they get into flow. So it really pays off to have that experience. But I think about 20% of Americans never experience flow. They probably have jobs they don't enjoy or that don't match their strengths. You usually get into that stage more easily if you're very skilled at what you're doing and when you enjoy what you're doing. And that's where the fun aspect comes in.
Yeah, I like the fun aspect. So dopamine doesn't guarantee that you'll experience pleasure though, right? It's all about anticipation of pleasure.
Yeah, right. So you should anticipate that something positive is going to happen.
So anticipate that something's going to be fun.
Yes.
And then hope and pray that it actually will be fun.
Well, very often, I mean, doesn't guarantee you, but I think that very skilled people who are in jobs they enjoy and that they're good at, they also enjoy it while they're doing. You know, when you are on stage and holding a keynote, I'm sure you enjoy it. You enjoy the moment. You're not just thinking, oh, this will be great afterwards. You enjoy it while you're doing it. So I think it can be in the presence as well.
Absolutely. I thought of this question as you were talking. Have you heard of nootropics?
What is that? Interesting. Tell me more.
Well, people that are trying to create safe, smart drugs to enhance your production of these various neurochemicals that you're talking, the very ones you're talking about.
Uh-huh. So in order to perform better at work,
yes.
For example,
yes.
So you're taking drugs a little bit like the, I don't know, you know, the Ritalin that people use with attention deficit disorder.
Yeah, sure, Ritalin. But yeah, these are not over the counter. These are things that are just, you know, like herbs and vitamins.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, I haven't seen any of those around. I usually think it's, well, I don't know about this. I mean, you can do a lot in order by having good nutrition. You know, the building blocks, the precursors for the neurotransmitters, you take them in through your diet. But I think actually it's more about changing your environment. I think if you're in the right environment that helps you perform well, you don't need any drugs. Mm. I think it's mostly people try to fix themselves. I think actually think it's easier to fix your environment than to change who you are. So let's say you're in the wrong job or you're having difficulties with your coworkers. I think it's much easier to maybe change jobs or speak to the people around you, change the task you're performing, than to always try to optimize yourself. I think a lot of things fall into place once you found your passion and once you found the right place where you're appreciated for who you are.
Yeah, and in an ideal world, we could kind of snap our fingers and appear in that environment. If we're kind of stuck in an environment, like say we have a contract or something, and still changing yourself can go a long way though, right?
Right, your attitude. And also, I think, you know, it's very good to have healthy work habits, such as, you know, I think if people exercise regularly, their resilience really improves. So even if you have a stressful work environment, you will do better if you sleep well, if you exercise regularly, if you eat well, and if you also have a good attitude, you know, if you have emotional regulation techniques. And there are many science-based emotional regulation techniques that people could use.
Ooh, go on. I'm taking notes.
One that I like a lot is called emotional labeling. You know, research has shown that if you, let's say you're very angry and annoyed at work, if you put a word on it, if you call it, you know, I'm angry, I'm annoyed, I hate my coworker. You don't have to say that to the person, you know, it's enough that you say that to yourself. And the moment you do that, it has been shown that the amygdala for processing negative emotions shows less activity and your prefrontal cortex for rational thinking increases its activity. So just by the fact of putting a name to your feelings, you will actually calm down your negative feelings.
That's really interesting. It sounds like it could be a really helpful technique. How does this relate to, like, you know, regulating your emotions? How does that relate to people that are kind of feel imposter syndrome?
Yeah, I think that's a real problem for people high up in organizations that very often, even though they have achieved a lot, they feel like they don't really, you know, it was all just pure luck. So they're thinking, oh, I've achieved so much, but it wasn't really me. It was just the circumstances. And one day people are going to find out that I'm not as smart as I might think. And I think one thing that really helps there is gratitude. If you can actually, there's a technique where you can, for example, write a gratitude diary. So every day you take 5 minutes to write down 5 things that you're grateful for during that day. So this is not about wishful thinking and saying things that didn't happen that you wish for. It's more about saying, like, I'm very happy that today I had 1 hour with my children that I really enjoyed, or today I did well on this and that. So it's about writing down what you're grateful for on that particular day. And if you do this on a regular basis, it will make you appreciate what you have, and it will make you see all the positive things in your life. And it helps you to not feel so stressed about the things that you can't control.
So even if it turns out you are a fake, like, at least you have gratitude for your loved ones. Like, at least they love you. At least they love the fake you.
I think it puts things into perspective. I think a problem with imposter syndrome is also that people put so much emphasis just on their jobs and everything else is empty. Maybe no family, no friends, no hobbies, because they're so much, you know, so busy in their careers that if something bad happens at work, the entire world crumbles. That is always a problem if you don't have other areas of your life that counterbalance that.
So gratitude sort of helps you get outside yourself, transcend yourself a bit. So not everything's so ego-driven.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Can you tell me a little bit about what is cognitive jujitsu?
Yes, that's about the fact that, you know, most people, when they have an emotion they don't want to experience, they suppress it. They use cognitive inhibition. Rather than saying, I feel jealous, as we just learned for emotional labeling, what you should be doing when you're jealous, they will pretend that they're just fine and they will try to suppress any negative emotions. What you should do instead is use other techniques. So work around that. Rather than trying to inhibit and fight against your emotions, you should work with your emotions. So one example is gratitude. Another would be emotional labeling. There's also research that shows that your body influences your emotions a lot. So you can use your body to change your feelings rather than using your prefrontal cortex, your rational mind, to inhibit them.
Oh, that's interesting. This idea of the rational mind as not always being the best tool for us actually relates to you, what you talk about in your intuition chapter. You have a whole chapter on the unconscious, right? So what is the difference between focused thinking and insightful thinking?
Yeah, rational thinking and insightful thinking. Well, you know, rational thinking, you just concentrate hard on a task and you go through it step by step and then you come to a logical conclusion. Many of our everyday problems are built on this. If I look at my clients, they often sit and they have an Excel sheet with a strategy and they just have to work through it, you know, and identify areas where they can improve the company or, you know, it's all a very logical business. But some problems, they have to be solved by creative insight. You know, they come through you as an aha moment when you're not thinking about it, when you're maybe taking a shower or taking a walk or feeding your dog. That's when you suddenly realize, oh, there's a different solution to it, you know, that I haven't thought of before. So this can't be worked out logically. It's about the occurrence of aha moments.
Yeah, absolutely. And you cite some of this research by John Kunios and Mark Beeman.
Yes, exactly.
The brain areas associated with insight. So those the neuroscience areas associated with insight are different than the neuroscience areas associated with controlled rational thinking. Is that right?
Exactly, exactly. And also, I think the most interesting thing about this research is that your mood, again, influences your occurrence of aha moments. As I've seen it, you know, for example, they showed participants funny videos prior to letting them solve difficult creative tasks. And it showed that when they had laughed a lot before and had, you know, the possibility to see funny videos prior to solving the test, they would perform a lot better. So the key in takeaway I take from this for my leaders that I'm working with is that it pays off to be in a good mood in order to be innovative.
There's this interesting line of research suggesting that actually mixed emotions are most conducive to creativity.
Oh, so a little bit of good.
At the same time, having kind of ambivalence, being excited, but also being fearful, you know, kind of like the more complex our emotions can be, seem to be more related to creativity. I'll send you an article on that. But maybe the point you're making, positive emotions can be conducive to a particular stage of the creative process, like insights, coming up with insights.
Yeah, or, I'm just talking about aha. Yeah. I know there's different kinds of creativity and, you know, it's a very complex area.
Yeah.
The one that I was focusing on here is just, you know, the aha moment. How can you get to aha? Kinds of insights that, you know, you can't solve logically. I'm not talking about all kinds of artistic creativity and, you know, it's a wide area.
Very wide. The whole creative process is your life, right? That's the whole process of life is creativity.
So there's much more to creativity than just aha insights. But I think, you know, there has been some very strong studies that showed that if you want to have more aha insights, it pays off to be in a good mood. And I think that's interesting because in the business world, very often people are very stressed and there's no laughing and no fun. It's all very serious. And I think many emotions are just neglected. And it's good for executives to hear that it's sometimes detrimental to not be in a good mood. And it does help productivity to actually also experience positive emotions at work.
Right. But how does that relate to your point about it's with self-regulation, you don't always want to inhibit. So sometimes when someone feels a negative emotion, you'd want them to express that, right?
Yes, you want them to express that. You don't want to suppress it. So you can say to your coworkers, if you have a good relationship, for example, you can say, you know, I'm very stressed out, but this will already be a relief. So the mere fact of labeling it and calling it out helps. This doesn't mean that you have to dwell on your negative feelings all day and put everybody else in a bad mood. I think if you use emotional labeling, then you get over it more quickly. And then I also advise to physically exercise in order to get that cortisol, the negative stress hormone, out of the system. And I think there's many things you can do to feel better. Emotional labeling does not say that you have to sit there all day at your desk and saying, I'm stressed, I'm miserable, I'm tired. I think you get tired of saying that to yourself after a while and then you switch to a different mode.
Yeah, I was just looking up this research. It does suggest there are some environments that when they bring out what's called emotional ambivalence, like the environment is unusual or it taps into a wide range of seemingly contradictory emotions, that actually can lead to greater creativity in the workplace. So that might be something interesting to consider.
Absolutely. I'm always interested in new things. You know, they never reach the business world otherwise. I think, you know, they don't. There's not much connection. So I'm always looking for new stuff that I can use and that I can bring to life.
Awesome. Yeah, we can swap articles and stuff. I'll send that over. I wrote this article called The Emotions That Make Us Creative for Harvard Business Review, and I'd be happy to share it with you.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'd love to have that.
So let's go on to habits, because that's a big topic on the Psychology Podcast that we talk about a lot. And what has your own research suggested about how we can adopt better routines?
Well, I don't have any own research on that topic. When I was in research, I actually worked on monkeys and the visual cortex. That's very far from any application. And that's also why I was so frustrated, because it didn't give me any answers to my big questions. I'm looking at other people's research always.
That's still research. I mean, you're researching, you know, what does research have to say about this stuff? So
yes, that's what I'm doing. I'm looking at everybody's research and new studies coming out and try to pull them together so they become applicable for business leaders. I think that's the job I'm doing. I'm building the bridge.
Yeah.
I'm not doing any research anymore. I work with executives, and I really, you know, I'm constantly checking the literature for new stuff that could actually be applied. And when it comes to habit change, you know, 97% of all New Year's resolutions fail, and people really are looking for new techniques to make habits stick. I really like the implementation intention research. You know, I think that works very well in the business work when you, rather than saying, you know, during Christmas holidays, I will work out more often, you say, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I go on my treadmill. So you make a when-then connection. I think that's very effective, and that can be implemented so easily in the business world by just, you know, finding a trigger that makes you go into a habit. Rather than just having these very vague intentions, you make them pragmatic instead.
Yeah, Gabrielle Oettingen, I think she might be a fellow German.
Yes, I've seen that you had her on the podcast. And I think, you know, that research, nobody in the business world knows about it. It might be widely discussed in psychology, but these leaders have never heard of her and her research. So what I'm doing is I'm bringing these things to them. And another thing I think that helps a lot with procrastination is to take very small steps. So rather than saying, oh, I'm going to lose 20 pounds and from tomorrow on, no more chocolate, never ever again, and I will just eat kale soup, which is the approach most people are taking to habit change. They just overwhelm themselves with these perfect big goals. Instead, you make a very small goal, you know, of eating maybe one piece of chocolate less than the day before, every day, a little bit less, or you know, one tablespoon of sugar less into your coffee each time you drink a coffee. Things like that make a real difference if they accumulate over time. But most people, when they want to change something, they make these very drastic, absurd, challenging ideas, and it just overwhelms us. I think nobody can endure this kind of new life anymore longer than 2 weeks. I mean, eat Brussels sprouts for 2 weeks, and then you're just going back to chocolate cake.
Yeah. And also, yeah. It's not really activating your fun system there.
No, and I think you need quick rewards in order to make a habit functionable. You need quick wins in the beginning. It cannot just be a long, miserable path to change. You need to build in some small rewards right in the beginning. And you need to, well, how do I put this? You know, rather than inhibiting unwanted behavior, it's better to create new neuronal pathways. So you should think of not only what you not want to do, but also about what alternative behaviors you want to display. And then make those alternative behaviors fun, because what most people will do is they say, oh, I will stop smoking and instead I will eat celery sticks. How much fun is that? Not so much. So you need to find an alternative behavior that actually giving you joy, because otherwise you're depriving yourself from all the reward and you're just getting a threat instead. And that is not going to work longer than 2 days or 2 weeks.
Just 1 second, Frederica. So I'm excited to tell you all about an exclusive offer. Bombas recently sent over some of their high-quality socks to try out, and I think they're pretty cool. My personal favorite are the Americanos. They're red, blue, and white with a really sporty patterning. I get a lot of compliments on the look. They're quite eye-catching. You can go to bombas.com/TPP and use our exclusive promo code TPP to get an exclusive 20% discount off your first order, along with a money-back guarantee. Importantly, though, I'm not just happy with their product. I'm enthusiastic about their mission. Bombas donates one pair of socks to the homeless for every pair purchased, and I think that's just great. They have a counter on their website and have already donated over 2,200,000 socks. I tend to talk a lot about the value of philanthropy and compassion on the show, so I'm really just very happy to welcome a sponsor that is doing its part to ameliorate the lives of people in need. So again, go to bombas.com/TPP and use our exclusive code TPP to get a discount. That's bombas.com/TPP. Now back to the show.
I like your method. I like that you're not getting rid of the fun. But is smoking fun, though? It's addictive, but is it actually fun?
Well, I think it gives you relief in the moment that you smoke, right? I think smoking builds up nervousness in your system. And then when you smoke, it's a little bit like, you relax. So, you know, you need to find different ways to relax
if
that's what you're getting. Like meditation, mindfulness meditation. But that also doesn't work in the moment if you do it for the first time. The problem with that is that you have to build a certain practice in order to make it work. It won't work the first day you sit down to meditate. It can make you just think of, I want a cigarette. You know, imagine that the first day you quit smoking, you sit down and you meditate instead. It might just make you very obsessed thinking about your cigarette.
Well, can't you smoke and meditate at the same time?
Well, I don't think it's very effective for getting rid of your unwanted habit.
Well, no, I don't think it would. No, but just to begin and then you slowly get rid of
smoking. Well, you could fade it out and then associate the reward the relaxation you get from the cigarette with a meditation, and then you make more and more meditation and less smoking. You could do small steps of first smoking the entire cigarette, next day you smoke half of it.
Cool.
Could work.
Well, I'm not a smoker, but I think that this could be very valuable information for my smoker listeners of a psychology podcast. So that's great. Yeah. So, you know, you talk about habits, and I am interested in this link between the habits and unconscious thinking. They seem so, I mean, habits are by nature kind of unconscious, right? Because they're patterns of behavior that we go through. Like, you know, we all have our things, right? My smoking is my picking up my nails.
You know, that's why habits are so powerful. There's unconsciousness. And when I was still in brain research, I worked with Wolf Singer, who, you know, on the visual system. And he said to me, and that really stuck to my brain, he said, you know, most of our thinking is unconscious, and we just use the remaining conscious parts of our brain to justify what we did afterwards. And I think that's a very important to acknowledge, that most of our brain activity is unconscious, and to use that to our advantage rather than going thinking, oh, there's no free will. Oh, my brain is just doing what it wants. I have no control. That's not very helpful. I think it's helpful to build powerful habits so that they unconsciously guide us towards the path of our success. So, you know, it's easy for our brain to engage in habits. You don't have to think about brushing your teeth in the morning. You don't have to think about the things you always do, eating your cereal in the morning. It's just a habit. You get down to the basement or, you know, and you start eating your fruit or your cereal or whatever. So it's important, and I think very useful, to install good habits, because you don't want to think about it every time you do something positive. You don't want to have to think, now I need to exercise. If you have an exercising habit, then you will automatically exercise every day without even second guessing your activity. Or, you know, if you have a habit of treating other people well, then you don't have to think about it. You know, if it's just an ingrained habit of appreciating other people, respecting other people, and you make that part of your nature, then you don't have to think, oh, now I need to praise my employees and give them a few compliments. That usually doesn't work so well, because they will feel that you just did this in order to make them work harder. Now, I just think installing good habits makes your life so much easier, because it takes a lot of energy from your brain to make deliberate decisions. You know, there's something called decision fatigue. You're just ego depletion if you're all day busy making lots of decisions. And the most executives I work with, they are very busy people. And you don't want to deplete these resources by constantly having to think about things from, you know, use your brain resource for the important stuff. So if you really want to make important decisions, then you can, you know, maybe use a quiet moment to really think about that problem. But all the other stuff you're doing on a daily basis should be put into habits so that you don't have to waste your energy thinking about them too much.
Right. So you want to hone your intuition in a way where your intuition is actually helpful and not hurtful to your goals. So what are some ways people can increase their intuitive decision-making skills?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I'm basing this on the insights of Gerd Gigerenzer from the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. You know, I asked him, what's the key takeaway from your research? What are you really bringing to people? And he said, when you have experts, give them limited time and give them limited information and then make them have a quick decision-making process. Don't ask them to justify themselves. Don't ask them for a million reasons why. Just make them have a quick decision-making process. And that makes a lot of sense because experts, they use their basal ganglia, where a lot of experience is stored, for decision-making, whereas beginners and people who are not experts will use the prefrontal cortex for a lot of the analyzing of the situation. And when you're, I think it's important to understand, are you an expert or not? Your brain has stored a lot of information on the topic, and then you can just access your basal ganglia to make a decision. And if you're not an expert, then you should actually go and do a lot of fact-finding and soul-searching and asking a lot of people and interviewing people and trying to look at the facts. So I'm not saying you should always use your intuition, because for a non-expert, what you experience as a gut feeling could also just be a bias. Let's say you think you're interviewing two work candidates and one seems smarter than the other. If you're not an experienced recruiter or not an experienced interviewer, you might just have a woman and a man and then you just think the man is smarter, for example. That's a very obvious one. But I'm just saying intuition truly works when you're an expert at the topic. So you should thrive to become an expert at things. And then you should trust your intuition and not think too hard about why you're making that particular choice.
Cool. But don't trust your intuition blindly.
Because it could also just be a bias.
Yeah, or a habit, a bad habit. A bad habit. Yeah.
A bad habit. And, you know, I'm thinking about this. Sometimes I compare this to car driving. The first time you get your driver's license, you're concentrating, right? You're driving and you're thinking, how do I push the brake? How do I turn the wheel? Oh, I need to look into the mirror. And all of these things are processed by your prefrontal cortex. You really have to focus and take in all the information. And you wouldn't even think in your dreams of having a phone call while you're driving or having a burger while you're on the road. And then 10 years later, that's what you might be doing because you're driving with a different body part. You're using your basal ganglia to drive. It's become a habit rather than a deliberate cognitive task to drive. And with decision making, you can make good decisions if you have good stuff in your basal ganglia. And that's why I think training is so important. You know, in the military, they really train people for emergency situations. Because when you're in stress, your prefrontal cortex doesn't work so well anymore. So you're accessing your habits, your basal ganglia, for a decision-making process. And then you want to make sure they have the right kind of information in there. You don't want them to access a bad habit. You want them to pull out exactly the right skill, the right way to pull the trigger, the right way to deal with an emergency situation. And that's why the police, the firemen, the military, emergency doctors, they all use a lot of drill in order to assure that the right kind of stuff is in your basal ganglia.
Yeah. When you said a lot that they use the right drill, do you mean practice?
Yes, I'm talking about practice. And in particular, I'm talking about overlearning. So you want to make sure that the right kind of information is in your basal ganglia. Let's say I get into an emergency situation on the street and somebody is almost dying and I rush and I am also not going to sit there and think about it for 10 minutes, what's the best approach? I'm just going to do whatever comes to my mind first. And since I'm not a trained doctor and not a nurse, intuitively seems right to me, but that is just wrong. And that's why people who need to make very quick decisions, quick intuitive decisions, need to have the right kind of training and very deep training in order to access the right information in very short time when in emergencies, for example, because it will save somebody's life if I have the right stuff in my basal ganglia.
And as you said, Gerd Gigerenzer has done some good research on that. Yeah, there's some other researchers. Klein
yes,
has shown that as well. Yeah, great. That's a great point. So let's go into the very last part of this interview and talk about teamwork.
Yeah.
What are the brain chemicals that make us different?
Oh, you know, I'm thinking a lot of Helen Fisher to that respect. I think her research on, and I've seen she was on your show as well, and she's a friend of mine. She, you know, she
you complete the dream team here of the psychology podcast.
No, and she has done such wonderful research on that topic because she has shown that there are four neurochemicals that are important for distinguishing personality. One is dopamine. And we talked about dopamine before. It makes you look for novelty. It makes you a very curious person. It makes you excited for challenges. Probably people with a very active dopamine system, they're always looking for the next new challenge, interesting things, interested in culture, in art, or in mountains and hiking. They always have something going for them. And then you have the serotonin, which is more important for mood stabilizing. So people who have a very active serotonin system, they're very loyal, they respect the rules, they enjoy a more structured work environment with, you know, if we relate that back to the you we talked to about in the beginning when we talked about peak performance, the people with a very active serotonin system, they actually don't need so much external stress to perform well. They actually have a very intrinsic motivational system. And then we have the testosterone. And I'm not just talking about men here. Women have it too. And that is about logical thinking, of being very tough-minded, interested in systems and structures. So the people who have a very active testosterone system, they are also very interested in going up in the hierarchy. They want to become bosses. You know, it makes you... there's a certain power drive behind that. They also have very good spatial abilities. Whereas people who have a very active estrogen system, and not just women, have a higher verbal fluency. And they have more of a net thinking. So they can connect topics that are not usually connected and see the big picture of things. And they're usually very empathetic and care about other people and have very good relationship, very deep relationships with other people. So you have these four brain systems, and she has really shown how they are connected to our personality. And I think that's amazing. And you can use that a lot in the business work. And she's now applying it in the business world as well. You know, she's moved away from applying that for matchmaking, and now she's applying it in the business world. And I think it's so important to understand that there's a genetic basis to personality and that you shouldn't change the way people are. You should rather acknowledge each other's strengths and work with those.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you drew on that research. And I'm wondering, like, the point there in terms of the importance of diversity for teams. Are you saying you need, or you literally need, a mix of these systems to make a good team?
I think it depends on the task at hand. If everybody in the team has the same job, let's say you have a bunch of journalists all writing, then you probably want to have people that are very high in estrogen and all of them are good at with words and writing and interviewing people. And then you don't need variety necessarily, but then you might have somebody else at the newspaper who has to talk to the advertisement people and get other, you know, get the newspaper to perform financially. And then you might want to have a person who's more structured, who has a high activity in serotonin. I think when you put a team together, you have to make sure that you get the right kind of person for the right kind of task.
Great point. Great point. I don't think diversity considerations are taken into account as much as they should. So when you personally go into work, into the workplace to consult, for instance, do you give people on the teams assessments, personality assessments? How do you?
Yes. If the client wants that, I actually give them Helen Fisher's neurocolor test, and then you can see where people fall in each of these four categories. And then, you know, it's very helpful when you have a team of people who work together. You can really see them having a hammer when they will say, oh, that's why he always asks for the numbers. You know, he's very high probably on either testosterone or serotonin wants to have all the facts. Now you understand why somebody else always turns in his material right before the deadline, because some people really need deadlines and a lot of pressure in order to work well. It's the people with a very active dopamine system. They need a lot of pressure. Otherwise, they will, you know, they're underperforming. And I think it helps for people to understand that we're all different. And there's also a concept that I think is very important, and that's introversion and extroversion. You need to understand people's needs. And some people work very well in the home office and perform better if you just leave them alone. And other people perform best when they have the open office space and lots of chatty colleagues around. It depends on who you are. And that, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with intelligence. People are just different. And I think a workplace environment needs to respect these differences.
I certainly agree with that. I wonder, could there be any potential danger in labeling people, though, in a sort of unchanging way that kind of sets, you know, like, oh, that's the high testosterone guy on the team. Oh, that's the high, you know, could there be costs as well as benefits of that approach?
I think this can happen with the old school approaches like the MBTI that have been used a lot in the business context. I think with Helen Fisher's research, if you use it right, she's saying type is dead, or actually also her partner, David Lapnow, is saying that type is dead. She's talking about neural signatures. So it's much more complex than just looking at your two most active systems. Let's say you have a high testosterone activity and also high dopamine activity, so probably you're a sensation seeker. She looks at all four systems and how they interact, because you can be high on both testosterone and estrogen, for example. That's something most people don't know about. And you can also be high on serotonin. So it's not about just the one substance you're high in or that is very active. She actually looks at all four of them and how they combine to make you unique. And I also think her research is very appreciative of differences. I think there's no style or signature that could be considered bad. You know, there's none that you could look at and say, oh, I don't want to be associated with that. Mostly when I give the test to people, they're very happy about their results. They feel like they want to show it to everybody. It's more, wow, now finally somebody gives me an explanation why I feel the way I do and why I behave the way I do. It's a, you know, if you know the people around you, you can make it easier to give them what they really need and what they really want, and that's a relief.
Sure. And the and Susan Cain's Quiet Leadership Institute, for instance, particularly has been looking at that importance of the introversion, extroversion dimension. But there certainly are other dimensions, so that's good. Could you take them into account? At the same time, I just want to make sure we don't stereotype people as well, or let them know. And also, I want to make sure we let people know that they can change. You know, these are dimensions, not types, like you said, you know, that through the course of our day, we can fluctuate back. There are moods where I'm more testosterone-y after coming from the gym.
Yeah.
There are moods where I'm more serotonin-y, you know, and it fluctuates in all of us, I think.
It fluctuates and people can change. I think, you know, there's a genetic component, but as we know, genetics is never 100%. There's always, you know, a mix of genetics and environment that makes us behave the way we do. And it's important to understand that you need both to understand a person. So there's a genetic component, but you can influence that a lot by how, you know, interact and how you challenge yourself.
Absolutely. What's the difference between a talent and a strength?
Well, a talent is more of a trait. A talent is more about what you're born with, so your genetic disposition, whereas a strength is those talents put at use by the accumulation of skills, for example, and training. So let's say you're very talented with music, okay, but nobody knew about it. And then one day you start by trying to play an instrument and then you really train that. And then you have a strength once you've really combined your genetic disposition with training. So talent and skills become a strength. And I think in the business world, it's so important, and not just in the business world, to play by your strength. You don't want to, you know, I would kill myself if I had to have the work of an engineer. I could never be really successful. It's just not the skill set that I have by natural disposition. So I could train a lot and I could do a lot of training and then I would probably pull it off somehow, but I would never experience the flow and the joy of really being very successful and very good at what I'm doing. So it's best to know where your talents are and then put a lot of practice in those areas of talent, because very often in organizations, what they do with executive coaching is that they take somebody's problem areas. They say, oh, you know, this person, he doesn't know how to present in front of an audience. So now we're sending him to 100 different presentation skills workshop, and we coach him on how he can present data. This person will probably never become a truly brilliant presenter, whereas he might or she might have a different talent, for example, in an artistic area for graphics and putting together beautiful presentations on in a graphic way, not by standing in front of people, but maybe by, you know, making illustrations or presentations on PowerPoint or something like that. And then this person could become the best possible expert at that in the company and really add value to the company by putting more hours of practice into that skill.
So interesting. It is just interesting to me how different people define the word talent in different ways, right? You know, like,
yeah,
you know, it seems like a lot of people have different definitions of that. And of course, nothing is purely genetically determined, as you know. Even our talents are all developed to a certain extent through the experiences. So that's just a really interesting way of looking at the difference between the two. Can I end this interview today by asking you, do you see a new era of leadership?
Well, I think companies are realizing now that people have needs and that it actually pays off to allow people to sleep and to take breaks and to exercise and to be treated well by their employer. And I think it pays off to create a brain-friendly work environment in which people enjoy what they're doing. I think people are catching on to that.
That's great. Well, I hope that your ideas proliferate more of the leadership community, and I wish you good luck with your new book.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Thanks for being here.
Again, this episode was sponsored by BombBoss. Check out their website, bombboss.com/TPP, and use the code TPP to get an exclusive 20% discount off your first order. You can also find the link in our podcast notes.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.